Hi, it's let's see, Monday, and tomorrow I'm starting school, so let me see if I can do this piece for Gnosim today. I'm looking through the catalog over here, and I see that one of them that caught my attention is, actually it's most unusual, it's Beis Meir and Eben Ezer. I'll talk about who the Beis Meir was in a second, but this is actually like the original, let's put it this way, this original printing from 1787, but that's not the point. And it has the Mechaber's extensive handwritten glosses, you know, Hagos, all over the place, which probably looks like the size of another Sefer, which I understand has been incorporated into the new edition. It's not the one I have. I have the one from 50 years ago, but the new edition from Mechon Yerushalayim, I think they put one out. You know, which, why not? So let's put it this way, if you're at all into this sort of thing, this is a very unusual piece. It's a treasure for a certain type of person if you appreciate it. And all you're talking about is 30 to 50K or something like that. So it's a chicken feed, right? So you're talking about the Beis Meir. I think the Beis Meir, once again, is one of these names that people hear, and for the vast majority, just two words, Beis Meir. For those who were into halacha, let's put it this way, so it's a little more familiar. Everybody's heard of Sefer Beis Meir, especially, as I'll say, when you get to certain kashrus questions and things like that, and some other areas. But even those, I don't think, know who the guy was. So that's what I want to talk about. So we're speaking about somebody who was a big rabbi in Germany, although the definition of Germany then is not identical to the definition of Germany today. Eastern Germany, Danzig, actually, in that area, in 1700s. I mean, he was lived to be 80 or 81 or 82, 1720, 1805, 1807, something like that. I mean, he lived into his 80s, which is not so common in those days. So he had a long life. And it would only be interesting to people who are listening to this podcast right now. You have to be of a certain type. And definitely if you're interested in the Gnosim auction, which is coming up this week. No, not this week. What is it? Gnosim is doing the auction on Sunday, September 7th. Yud-Dalad Elos, I guess today's Rosh Chodesh, 2 weeks from today, right? 2 Sundays from today. And if you're interested at all, obviously, those are players. You look up under Gnosim online, G-E-N-A-Z-Y-M. Remember that. G-N-A-Z-Y-M. And what I'm looking at is in the catalog on page, what? Can't see what page it says, like near the beginning. It's lot number 5. That's how they identify it, okay? Lot number 5. 16, page 18 as I see it. I don't see the number, but it should be page 18 in the catalog. If this is something that's interesting. Meis chidush ha-shlomas be'etzem k'sav yag tosha shal machaber. That's how they're advertising it. Ha'otek ho'ishi shel ha'machaber. That's true. It was a guy. So in other words, he published one book in his lifetime, and this is it. And then he wrote a lot of notes to it. And I think I know. I would say I know why. I flatter myself I know why. If you know who the guy was, we're dealing with somebody who very much fits the pattern and the mold of people I've been talking about a lot lately. Although not like Naftali Katz, it was a magician and all that, sorcerer, but the opposite, straightforward, just learning. And you'll say, so then what's the difference? Guys like there were a dime a dozen. There is some truth to that in the 18th century. That is true. You can't deny it. On the other hand, there are some people that rise to the front ranks. And there are others that rise not to the front ranks. All I can tell you is, if you don't know who the Beis Meir is, when Rabbi Akiva Eger had a shiloh, he said it to him. I'm very serious. In fact, I'm looking now at, I happen to have, I picked up years ago, oh, it is Mechon Yerushalayim, but it's not the original one. How do you like that? It's because mine is like from the 1970s, and they had other things, I believe, unless this one includes it. If it does, well, lucky me. Anyway, I just opened it at random. You'll see, he was a big rabbi in Eastern Germany. That's who he was, especially in many decades in Danzig, or the Jews weren't allowed in Danzig itself, so it was the Pikesville of Danzig, like Jackson to Lakewood, you know, Spring Valley and Muncie. There's the town, and then there's a place where the Jews lived adjacent to the town. It was called Scotland, by the way, Shotland, because it was, settled by, back in Poland times, by refugees from Scotland, believe it or not. Must have been Catholic, I guess. Anyway, I just opened at random over here, if you want to know who our guy is, and he's got a question over here. Miyididi Rabbi Hagon Kibager, and what is it? Pidyon HaBen B'Zayna. This is real life. In other words, we're in the 18th century. We're in North and Central Europe. The Jewish community is still one big community, includes everybody. The wicked, the righteous, and mamish, from the pietists to the pimps, they really do, to the prostitutes. And some girls end up getting in trouble, as they say. And here's a girl that got pregnant, and now she says it's her bechor. This is a question sent to him, from Rabbi Kibager. I wouldn't want to handle it myself either. Nistapakti b'dabar shaboy lai penuya shaharz lisnunim. Says a girl got pregnant, she's not married. V'yolda ben zachar b'chor peter rechem limo. V'hi amra miyisrael kosher. Right? Lo mikon a levi. Nisarba. So she said, needs a pinyan ben. It's not a kohen, it's not a levi. Because not everybody knows that. Ima ben chai b'pinyan ben kesha yagdil. Do einan emenis l'chai b'misofik. Right? Those maybe, how do you know she's telling the truth? It's a suffix. And he goes into the whole thing, Alpha Dasa Rasha, Ritva, Sugidishtuki, there's a rove, even there's a suffix, Shema Ozla Iu Gabayu, Hachinam Havdi Rove, Shainam Kohanim Leviim, because rove is not Kohanim Leviim. Aftain Hokum Mamrach a rove, but in other things, Yishlim, Bernada Rove said, no gave a moment, and no one, and no one, and no one, and no one. So, I mean, you got to be pretty good to get questions from Biki Vega. That's all I want to say. On the other hand, our hero used to send his shalos to the Nodi Behuda. If you look in the Nodi Behuda, there's a number of shalos from our hero, from the base mayor. He's called Mayor Posner. Yeah, I know that, but that's not his real name. No, they don't have a name like my name is Katz or something like that. These are nicknames people used to give. So our hero was born somewhere. You know, the biographies are pretty much the same. They run in the same rut. In other words, he was the son of a famous Rav that you never heard of, okay? And in other words, because there were a lot of these people in Poland and Lithuania, those places, and Galicia, small communities, and they had big gonim as the local rabbis over there, and they had children. And so our guy's born here in 1725, and obviously, if it's the 1700s, it's before the Haskalah hit, and he learns with his father and so forth. And obviously, we wouldn't be talking about him if he didn't have a Gaonish ahead. And therefore, naturally, when he's 13 years old, he gets married. This is the old days. And what do you call it? Who does he marry? A rich girl from Posen. Get it? That's the thing. So he moved in with her family like they used to do. Right? So Mechel Shulchan Chosen, as they call it. And from 13 to 20... he's growing up as a husband and probably a father. Isn't that weird? You know, that was every day. This all happened to your great-great-great-grandparents and mine. And he's also growing up as a Gaon. Let's put it this way, okay? And I remember, and here's the thing. If you want to know who he is and how you turn out this way, I remember somebody mentioned over here. Let me see. You'll see what I mean. He learns with this guy, with the wife, and then when she died, so let me see, that would be in 1750. So he got married in 1738. Yeah, so 12 years after marriage, his wife died, and then, so all those 12 years he was plugging away. I guess they support him for 7 years, and 5 years he did it some other, probably stay an extra years. Let's put it this way, the dates don't work out, but his wife died not that long after, and he remarried, he moved to Lisa, you know, Rabbi Yaakov Lisa, you've heard of that. These are all, so all the places I'm telling you are in a funny place. It's along the Baltic Sea. It's Northern Europe, therefore. It's used to be called East Prussia. But on the other hand, parts of it were part of the old Kingdom of Poland. The Duchy of Prussia itself originally was a province of Poland that the German Dukes of Brandenburg, Electors of Brandenburg, had held in fief to the Kings of Poland, et cetera, blah, blah, blah. I don't have to give you all that. And eventually, the Prussia became a German state of its own and swallowed up Poland, as you know, or a big part of it. And so they'll have, in his lifetime, the three partitions of Poland. And Frederick the Great, the King of Prussia, will take up a big bite. And there'll be a lot of Jews located in this area. And these are places where they had lots of small Jewish communities. So it's not like Galicia, which is in southern Poland and all the way on the other side. This is near Lithuania. And so the Jews over there are like, I'll call half Yekish and half Litvish. That's really the truth. And they had some heavy hitters over there. I mean, the most famous name that you would think of and associate with Danzig, who's a contemporary of our hero, is the Chayyim. Avram Danzig. I mean, that's where that's where he's from. But you see how life was? Avram Danzig went to learn in Prague, in Central Europe. And our hero hangs around mostly in Posen and then in northern parts of Europe over there. And when he marries a second time, here's the thing. For 14 years, he spends in Lisa. So that's in addition to the 7 or 10, whatever years he put in there. He put in decades in learning. And wait a minute. In a base medrash, which was like a certain kolel, okay? So here's a guy who loves learning, obviously. And this is a society in which a lot of people go to yeshiva, but then they drop out along the way because there's no money. How many people would stay in learning today if there was no money? I'm serious. And then there's the yechidim that somehow or other money. So either you come from a rich family and the family wants to bankroll you. That's one way, no question about it. And the other way is if you're perceived as some rising Eloi, maybe marry into a rich family and they'll support you. That's another way. And that's what happened to our hero. And when the first wife died, he did a second time. But they get value for money because when they're supporting a son-in-law learning in those days, the idea usually wasn't simply, oh, how pious and from they are and blah, 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 the way people think about it nowadays. I have a son of learning, which is good, all the rest of it. But if it's a rich guy, he wants value for money. So basically, I'm willing to bankroll a future Vilna Gaon. A guy who's just going to be a balabus and knows how to learn, give a daf yomi shir in the Velderon. Heck with it. I'm not wasting my money on that. So the people, it was like a certain stock market. And here you have a kid 13, 14, 15 years old, that kind of thing. And then it goes by reputation. And to be perfectly honest, how does the father-in-law know who's really good at learning? But he's relying on others to say, very much like the Shidduchim. And except here you date, you know, there's no such thing as dating and learning. But they would have people talk to the guy to test him. That I know. That actually happened to my father in a certain situation, but I won't go into that. Anyway, and this is just a different society. I'm just trying to give you an insight into a different world. And the richy riches want value for money, and they often got it. So in our case, they got it. So whoever bankrolled them the first time, well, unfortunately, you can't foresee that the wife would die. And he bankrolled them the second time. He didn't have to work. And so he had years and years to be in learning, and he used them. He emerged the base mayor. So in other words, if they wanted value for money, they got it, because if the father-in-law lives in Posen and he's always going to call her a mayor Posner, that's close enough to getting fame. And he's a perfect example of what I'm talking about. Perfect example. Now listen to this. B'dibek haver charifim b'kim yir Hashem nischabarti. That for 14 years, from the age of, I guess, 30 to 45, something like that, something in those areas, a little older, in 14 years, he had the luxury of being what you and I would call an elite kolel, with other guys that are elite members, because they're all the same type. There's somebody's son-in-law, or somebody's brother-in-law, or somebody from a family, or somebody who somehow or other is able to take off a long time from work and throw themselves into learning. And Bedivik Harifim became this Chabar to be Havayis the Rabba Basaknu, Alahadrik Mishkan Aposkim Rishon Bachrom Yeradu. Which means that they all got together. I don't know how many, was it a dozen, two dozen, something like that. Some famous names, by the way, Rameir Wall was there. You know, some famous people you've heard of. And it's a little bit like the Noda Behuda situation that he also spent 10 years in the Cloys of Brody. The Cloys of Brody is very famous and renowned in literature, but there were a dozen of these places, and I don't mean to exaggerate over there. Maybe more. Not everybody heard about it. Did you hear about Lisa, Leszno, as they call in Poland? And there were in other places. There were, if you were lucky enough to be in there in a group, then I know what these guys did. Like something. You don't see this too often today. And I'll tell you what I mean. When you have a kollel, usually, as I understand it, it's past my time, but I understand it. So that's when the guys get serious, and let's say they make a chabur in Yerodea, you know, let's say, for example, in Kashrus, or in Nida, or in Hilchus Shabbos, or something like that, isn't that right? And if you want a little fancier, some places they'll have a kosher mishba kollel, all of which is great. And what it means is, you're not just going to be, then I'm going to learn for 5 years, two prakim here, a parak and a half there, a sugya here, a thing there, chop, plop, shmop, and, you know, when you come out, it's nothing, you know, tangible. But rather, let's say they want to be rabbis, I mean in the best sense of the word, and definitely want to halacha, and so they're going to learn Erevin. Right, they're gonna learn Shabbos, they're gonna learn whatever, right? Like I say, you know, Shechita, Basar Chol, whatever. So how do you do it? So you say, well, you know, if you do it right, and they have these kolas, in fact, I'm sure that's what many, many kolas are talking about. Now, I'm not talking about the brisker thing we're doing Kachem, put that aside. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about, you know, in Halacha Lamaisa areas, because where does the future people supposed to come from? And so if you do it right, what do? You do all the Gemaras and the Rishonim and this and that and the other. And eventually you get, but you know, and you do it cold, solid. And especially, by the way, if the guys are accomplished the way this Kollel was back in the 1700s. So they all know how to learn very well. And therefore, when you do the Sugya, you talk it through. You know, the Rashi and the Tosas and the Rif and the Ron and all that. Okay. And then you go to Beis Yosef, right? Right? And all the stuff with the connected with the Beis Yosef, with the Darkei Moshes and so forth. So by the time you get to the Shulchan Aruch, I mean, you're really, your hands are deep in the Parsha, and you know what you're talking about. And then you're in a position to have an opinion. So these guys did it with Dal Chalki Shulchan Aruch. That's my point. Okay? This wasn't a Nida Chabura or a Shabbos Chabura or a Erev Chabur or something like that, Tevilas Kalim, it's the whole nine yards, baby. Or Chaim, Ebenezer, Choshim Mishma, you know, Yerodea. That's how they did it. It takes forever. Yeah, that's why I was there for 14 years. That's what I'm saying. And these were already people who were big, big in the first place. So don't be surprised when I say there were a lot of people like this. There were and there weren't. I mean, there were a lot of people in learning and Choshim, all the rest of it, but the ones that got the elite, were the ones like the Noda Behuda and the Beis Meir and people like that who had the kind of luxury and experience that I'm talking about, that they could say, listen, we are starting the Shulchan Aruch from A and we're going to Z, baby. And we're going to do, you know, all the Rishonim and all the Achronim and so on and so forth. The closest I would say for somebody listening to this is think of the Mishnah Berurah and the Be'er Halacha. You know what I mean? You got to go through everything and then get all the sheets down and so forth. I mean, it's an exhaustive process. And they're doing it from scratch. They're not doing it backwards like you and I do from the Be'er Halacha. Oh, he has three sheets over here. Let's look that up. You know, you're doing it from scratch. This is the old way. Now, if you can handle this boot camp, you come out of Gadol. That's all. It's as easy as that. All you have to do is just do that. So, here we are that he's got to be 50 years old. So if it's born in 1725, he had to start out in the 1760s, 1770s in the rabbi business. You understand? In the rabbi business. And as is the case, he was around in a small town until he got to a more chashuv place. The small town was Meserich, the one, not to Magada Meserich, the other one in northern Poland. Okay? And apparently he was there for 4 or 5 years. And then eventually, he gets into Prussia proper, to Königsberg, which was the capital of East Prussia, a port city with well-to-do Jewish merchants and all the rest of it. And eventually goes to what even a bigger Jewish community, not that they're so large, you're talking about 1,200, 1,500 people, which in those days altogether was a lot. And that's the sprawling complex of what we would call today Danzig, or Gdansk as they call it in Poland. And Danzig is a very important port city, and therefore a lot of Jewish merchants want to hang around there. So it's a lot of Geisha merchants and government officials that don't want them there. You have the old existential tension. On one hand, they hate the Jews, and they really do. And then on the other hand, for economic reasons, they need them. And so the Jews end up settling in a series of suburbs, shall we say. Today, they're all part of the city. But, you know, in those days, there were villages near the city. And he has a whole tshuva on the Erev over there and the river running between and all that kind of stuff, if you're actually interested in that. And The reason I say it is, you've heard of Altona, Hamburg, Wandsbek, where Jonas and Amish was Ahu. So again, you have three communities that are very close to each other, and they have one big rabbinate, even though one is in Denmark in terms of sovereign territory, and one's in the Republic of Hamburg, and one's in the other one, the Duchy of Oldenburg. So even though they're all near each other, because it's Europe. So in the case of our hero, the big community. Well, this is, by the way, this is west of Königsberg, to the left. Now, today, by the way, Königsberg is part of Putin's Russia. It's a little island of Russian sovereignty that Russia insisted on when they let Poland leave the Iron Curtain. That'll be the next crisis after Ukraine is over. Mark my words, remember where you heard it. But we'll leave that alone for now. So, in 1780 or so, what would our hero be? His 50s, right? So he becomes, and he's there till his 80s. He becomes the rabbi of the communities in Danzig, especially Schottland. That's how he always signs himself, Shin Lamed, Schottland, and Weinberg, and Landsfurth. So Weinberg's the name of a little community near Danzig. That's what it is. Those Jews who have named Weinberg, the original thing comes from there. Now, maybe there was a place with wine over there, but it's just interesting. And these three or four communities had, were within walking distance of each other, I suppose. And I wasn't over there. My father was over there in the concentration camp in Stutthof, but that's a different story. And this was a chashuva community back in the day. And if you want proof of how chashuva was, who did he replace who died there, who was a rabbi there for many years before then? The answer is the Sidrei Torah. In the back of the Shulchan Aruch, on Nida, Rochanan, Ashkenazi. So that means the community, though not large, had enough money that they wanted to get a chashuva guy to be a rab. Once upon a time, a sign of a Jewish community that's chashuv is they have a chashuva talmud chacham for rabbi. That's what it was. So that's who our hero is. So he is somebody who spent decades and decades just learning without having to do anything. But of course, he's not wasting his time. So you can be darn sure somebody like this, I'll tell you right now, they're up at the crack of dawn and they're learning till late at night. That's what it is. So you're getting value for money. But on the other hand, he wasn't a businessman like the Chayyotim was. And he wasn't a this, he wasn't a that. He was just learning. And most of his life, he wasn't a rabbi. He didn't have to be. So when this community took him, that means he already had a very big reputation, which was true. And he had been a rabbi in the small town of Mezerich for 4 years. And he could see that the guy has the schaira, which was true. And therefore, he became a famous person. And the reputation spread throughout Europe. And that's why you find people like Rabbi Kiva Eiger, who eventually later moves to, is a rabbi near there, in Marcus Friedland and Posen, which is all in the area I'm talking about. It's hard to know. If you don't have any sense of historical geography, it's probably very hard to know what I'm saying, because the borders have changed so much. This whole Eastern Germany doesn't exist anymore because Hitler misused it. And therefore, when the war was over, that whole chunk was torn away from Germany and given back to Poland, which had been ancient terms. So today, Danzig and Schottland, and by the way, there's Old Schottland and New Schottland, and Weinberg and all these, and Lisa, they're all in Poland. And the Poles kicked out the Germans. Stalin let him do it. That's the only good thing he did to Poland. And the whole Silesia and the whole East Prussia is now in Poland. So areas which were, this is funny, areas which were famous Jewish communities once upon a time, and some have cemeteries there still. I don't think shoals, but the cemeteries. And which was back in the Polish days, are now once again back in the Polish days. But in those days, the Jews in that part spoke German and Yiddish because of the Prussians. So so that's what we're dealing with. And he's able to publish in his lifetime, in 1787, I think, the base mayor on what he called, on Ebenezer. It becomes a classic sefer. But it's like all the others for him. It's comments on Shulchan Aruch and Shas. And these Shas and Tshuvas I'm looking at weren't published till much, much, much later. You know, posthumously. And so the only book he published in his lifetime is the one on the Ebenezer. But I'll tell you right now, I know this person. Because of what I just described to you before, think about what I'm about to say. If you're a real gaon and you're used to spending years talking and learning all the time with people of your level for 14 years, 15 years, 20 years, you're constantly reanalyzing. And it's never good enough. And I mean that in a good way, not in a bad way. Rashi had this problem also, right? That's Madur HaKam, Madur HaShnia. If you're really, really good, there's never your final word on the subject. You learn the sugya again, you learn the halacha again, and you see an angle you didn't see before. And what did John Maynard Keynes say? When I get new information, I change my mind. What do you do? You know what I'm saying? And a really honest person, Tom Chacham, doesn't say, well, I once paskened this, therefore I'm stuck with it. And if he's getting shalos, which he is, up to the Mississippi, he's getting all the time questions from all over the place, you're constantly revisiting the sugya. Because there's nothing that makes you, and again, I mean this in a good way, I don't mean this in a bad way, nothing makes you think and rethink what you did before than having to face this shaila. So in other words, let's say, for example, I'm just making this up on the spot. Let's say that he had, when he learned the sugya about the mamzer and the pinyan ben, he said, no. But now, a new situation arises, and the question caused him to rethink it, and talk it over with his other colleagues on the base and all that. I see it different now. I see it different now. So why am I saying this? If you buy this item from Gnosim, it's the original printing of the base mayor, his own personal copy, but it's full of, it seems like hundreds, maybe more notes, extensive notes on the side. And I don't know how they got this. He said extensive notes on the side. And I'll bet you a lot of times he's commenting on his own comments and saying, you know, I left this out, or I rethink this, or I changed my mind, or something like that. All of which is 100% what Rashi did and what everybody else does. They say the same thing about Riyud HaNasi. He did the Mishnayos two times, right? What's it called? Mishnah Rishona, Mishnah Achrona. The Rosh Hashanah says that. And let me tell you something. If Riyud HaNasi had lived another 20 years, he would have done a Mishnah Shlishis. Because, you know, how should I put it? As long as you're alive and you're active and your mind is active and you're gone, you don't simply say, I said this once. You revisit. You know what I'm saying? You revisit. And if you're Mavakesh Yisro MS, you don't say, oh, I said this once, so therefore, you know, and people heard me say it. So this is very interesting. It's a most unusual item that they're auctioning over here, right? Which is, you know, the author's own critical notes on his published work. And I don't only mean, oh, they made the printer made an error over here. I'm sure there's some of that also, because that happens, obviously. And if you look at the Sefer, just go online or get the catalog and you'll see it's a lot of dense print. I'm not going to call it chicken scratch print, but it's close to it. It's a lot of dense print, you know, on the Ebenezer. And there's plenty to talk about, obviously, all those halachas. And he has on the other, he didn't publish, but he has on the rest of the Shulchan Aruch as well. And on Shas, I don't know what the public, I mean, I know from time to time this has come out. The other stuff in the Shulchan Aruch has come out, especially Aruch Chaim, I know. But and he gave it different names, but we call it Beis Meir. You know, he calls it Kenyan with Salas Habayis and Kenyan Day and all this stuff. But you know how it goes. People just call it the Beis Meir, and probably so. But I don't think most people know what Beis Meir is. Now, if you're in the, me, myself, and I, I can't say I've gone inside the Beis Meir and all. Maybe I looked at it a few times. But I always know, it's just funny to me, the Beis Meir is known very much for the thing on the Dabar Charif. Moshe Shulchan wrote a thing for this, for the Star K on this. But I remember it. I have it in my rusty, trusty, what do you call it? What's it called? Here. Bari HaShulchan. I always used to call this the Hanukkah question. Because in Hanukkah, I used to get all these questions, even before I was in the rabbi business, from Mindy and others. It happens. You make latkes, let's say, and you put the, and these potatoes and it's onions. That's the point. It's onions, the Dabar Charif. And it put it through the blender. And then the question then becomes, but it was parv. But it, no, it wasn't. Yeah, well, let's put it this way. The onions was parv and the potatoes was parv. But it turned out it was, let's say, for example, a milchiga blender or a fleishiga blender. And now can use it, let's say it's a fleishiga blender. And it used to happen a lot. I got this question many times. And I'm going by memory here. And, but well, I'm supposed to be serving this with sour cream or something. Like, what do I do? You know, and always just had it in my mind. It's the Chochmas Chanim versus the Beis Meir. That's how I have it memorized. And one second over here, pulling out my rusty, trusty Bali Shulchan. Yeah, here you are. Because I highlighted it. That's my policy. If I see a good heter, you highlight it. It says in the Shulchan Aruch and Tzadi Vav in your day, Tavlan Sheni Dochum and Meducha Shel Basar Ben Yomo Asalachim Mecholav. So that's the case. It was a Dabar Charif, it's Tavlan. It was a question of Meducha of Fleishigs, and it was a Ben Yomo. And what do you call it? Don't do Milchuk, that's the Mechaber. And the Ramah says, Afil ain't a Ben Yomo. So that's really strict. That's strict. So I'm seeing over here at the bottom, I highlighted so I'm reading you the notes from the Bari HaShulchan. Because as everybody knows, when you Dover Charif, you don't do with nos and tal of gam. Because the Dover Charif makes it that it's not nos and tal of gam. And here's the famous Beis Meir. And he says, and the Beis Meir, observing, and believe me, he went through the whole thing from top to bottom. He says, this Ramah that says, even Zeinu Ben Yomo, so if the knife, for example, was Zeinu Ben Yomo, or the Meduch, whatever it was, if Zeinu Ben Yomo, you're only Machmel Chachila, Al Bediyevet, Shinesar Vimacholov, Gamba Ramah Yesh Lahakal Bedino. Why? Because there's three Svaras Lahater. This is the famous part. In other words, if it was just a question of Zeinu Ben Yomo, and it's a Dabar Charif, all right, you're Machmer. If it's a question of just of not bar not, and it's, and it's a Dabar Charif, you're Machmer. And if it was a question that it was not a just a Tznon, which is the classic case of Dabar Charif, but it was something else, so you're Machmer. But you have all three, right? Gimel Svaras Lahater. It was a case of Eina Ben Yomo, and it's a case of not bar not, right? And it's also a case, because that was the situation, and it's also a case where it wasn't, in other words, it's an onion. So it's not a tzinnon, it's not a radish, which is the classic case of the Dabar Charif. And some hold that that's not a cold Dabar Charif. Oh, here he is. L'dugma, 1 minute. Im chorchu b'tzolim b'sakin cholev v'sheinu ben yomo. There you have it. V'nosim b'kader shel bosa yish l'hater b'diyevet. All I'm saying is, that's a very famous Beis Meir. I've met many times this question, and other rabbis, you know, also, everybody immediately says, yeah, the Chochmas Chanim versus the Beis Meir. Now, what's my point? We know this Shita. Did we see it inside the Beis Meir? I can't say I did, you know. But it's very well known, and it's brought down in all the Achronish stuff and so forth. And that means he's a real player. That's my point, okay? Now, it's funny. It's him versus the Chochmas Chanim. They're both from Danzig, right? So, if if I was having one of these kitty type thing, Moshe said that they made something up about the Naftali cats with the kitty cartoons or something like that. You could say the famous latke that caused a fist fight between the base mayor and the chayotim. They were once in a house, and Don's like, you could really shoot the bull with this stuff. But so that's who the base mayor is, right? He's a major posik from this time. And he even, now, one of the tests, by the way, of being a big posik in the 18th century is, are you involved in machlekes? I know it sounds like I'm saying something funny, and to a certain degree it's funny, but to a certain degree it's not funny. Anybody that you know was a big name in the 18th century participated in the machlekes. Maybe it was Emden Abschitz fights, maybe it was about the chicken without the heart, maybe it was about the get me cleaver, you know, maybe it was about you know, those noti hooded things with the get, you know, with the shliach for the get. There's so many of these famous controversies that raged in the 18th century, most of which are not known to the public. You only know among those that know them. It's funny. I mean, I understand how funny that sounds, but it's true. You understand? And one of them, and I'll just share you with this because the base mayor I know is part of this, even though I don't see him being part of the other fights. I don't think he was in the Get McCleaver, for example. He was too young at that time. That was in 1763. And he wasn't, yeah. But in his time was the, what do you call it? The fight about the publishing of the shasas. A whole genre of big controversies and machlokes throughout Jewish history, well, no, not throughout Jewish history, ever since the printing press, was when let's say, Reuven, Shimon, and Levi. Reuven wants to publish the shas. He raised a lot of money, puts a lot of time and effort into it. So he wants to get like a cherem that rabbi should issue and say nobody can compete with him for 5 years so he can sell it out. So he won't go bust. And then Levi goes and just does it anyway. And he gets his rabbis. And then you have fights between Rabbi Group Team A, Rabbi Group B, and then Shimon gets it. Reuven, Shimon, and Levi. You know what I mean? You have three shots going at the same time. And they're all kind of issues that can involve. So in the 18th century, it was the big fight between the Amsterdam Shas on the one hand and the Sulzbach Shas on the other. Amsterdam is in Holland, obviously, and Sulzbach is all the way in Bavaria in southern Germany. You know, the heart of Yekiland. And there was a family, Pupus, who were Kohanim in, it's all well, what I'm telling you now is well known. He says, in Amsterdam, and they raised the money, and they put it together, even though the truth of the matter is they were a little bit horning in on another shas that had been published in Frankfurt, the Oder. So you see what I'm saying? There is a history. I was looking for this. There's an article I saw online. I wasn't able to get a hold of it from Professor Yedidia. Came out in Sion last year, I think. One of the big fights about Yid, probably goes into detail. And Gideon got me the second Martin Heller book, part of it, which is in there. I have the first Marvin Heller book, which is about the history of all the printing of the Talmud in the 1500s. But I don't have the one in the 1600s, 1700s. These are people that really want to go in all the nitty-gritty of the printing history of the Talmud, which is a fascinating subject. If you're interested in all anything I'm saying on this line, the starting point is to get, which is probably online. I mean, this text is probably online, what they call Maimar Alad Pasad HaTalmud from the Dikduki Sofrim. The guy who put out the Dikduki Sofrim back in the middle 1800s in Germany, the Litvak, who did it in Germany, Rafal Nosanothra Rabinowitz. And when he put out the Dikduki Sofrim, which is, I've talked about before, I'm not going to repeat myself, he found this unbelievably rare, untouched, and high-end shas, which had been untouched by censors and was in exquisite, what's the right word? Penmanship and art and this and that and the other, and he published all the differences. And let's put it this way: and you found in there a lot of better gears than you find in the printers' editions, because all the printers' editions make mistakes, as we know. And without going into that in great detail, he appended to it when he started publishing it. And believe me, he got 50 or 60 eskamas from every chashev rabbi in Europe in his time to do it. I mean, you name it, you know. The Ksav Sevri, it's called the Specter, and the Archoner, and the Sholem Meshev, and you name it. You know, so people shouldn't say, oh, it's not from. And he has an essay from the history of different editions of the Talmud, Maimrel at Pasad Talmud. Okay? It's now sold separately by the Moser Rav Kook. If you're really interested in it, just look up Maimrel at Pasad Talmud. You can either buy it or it must be online. And he happened to go through all the nitty-gritty details of this. Years ago, I bought at Shopsies. Nobody wanted it. It must have been the anniversary of the publication of the Talmud, maybe the art by the art school or something. It's a book in Hebrew. I don't even know what the title is, and it's Gevaldik, and it's frontispieces of all the published editions, and a little bit about each one, or more than a little bit, and samples of each one. So I have in front of me right now all the business with the different editions of the Talmud and what they look like, and samples of them, and what do you call it? I have here in front of me a whole big thing on the Tavus Amsterdam, you know, Tufkot Yubez, the Tufkot Cafe, meaning it took them a decade to publish this business, and let me see here. It came out, it was attacked. But Madura Zu Yafa Ma'od Mugas Ma'od, that this is a very pretty edition. In other words, a very fine edition of the Talmud. They aren't all. Fukafi Madura's Frankfurt Domain, and it's based on the Frankfurt edition. Kosim, and the, in other words, in Propus, the Amsterdam guy got all these Haskamas who say, Adain Lukol Azman Shagalar Arbonne Mafisi Berlin and Frankfurt Dorda Bishnas Tav Tzadal. It's true that the cherem that they put out in 1734 for the publishers of the Shas in Berlin and in Frankfurt Dorda, which is the other Frankfurt in East Germany, that time is not run out. Ulam Mikimish Shed Pisu Bedfus Rao Matushbush Matushtosh Umruba Tuuyos. You see how it works? You know, they put out, they say, nobody should compete with this shas for 10 years or 20 years or 30 years, whatever, so they'll have a chance to sell it out. But then the other guy comes and he says, like this, yeah, but mine is better print and has less tosa tfuses and things like that. Oh, okay, in that case, since it's a matter of better quality, then you can publish yours. And then, right in the middle of this, in Germany, near Firth, where they had the biggest yeshiva in Germany. So in Sulzbach is a small town. It's the headquarters of a German state of the Palatinate, which you never even heard of, the Pfalzgraf, as they call it. And there weren't usually too many Jews over there, but the elector of the Count Palatine, who was a prince in that part of Germany, on the Rhine River, on the other side of the Rhine River. And who's Christian August? Right, Christian August. He was, first of all, a very tolerant guy. He let people be both Catholic and Protestant. Even at that time in Germany, the rule was cuius regio, eius religio. Whoever the prince is, you got to do his religion or else. But he was tolerant in that. And even let Jews in there because he was interested in the Kabbalah. What do I mean by Kabbalah? Because he was the employer of Christian Rosenroth, who was the big Christian Kabbalist. They're looking to find rayas for Christianity from the Zohar. I understand it's crazy. I'm just telling you. And that made them amenable to being a publishing place for Jewish books. It's unusual in Germany. You had such a nice environment. And so a guy wanted to publish over there, whole shas, and all hell broke loose because the guy Propus in Amsterdam said, who gave you permission? And he got the Vada Barotzes to put a cherem on it. And in 1 minute, let me move the page over. Kasha Hiskal Afasa Adbosa Shazeh, Shochu Shneimasar, Megoni Poland, Rabboni Arba Rotzes, Charmus Alamatfis, Alkon Madurazu. That the guys from Amsterdam got the Vada Arba Rotzes, which is the big group, to send letters of cherem against it. Mapisi Amsa Bisus, Charmus Vizuko Yisrael. And naturally, the publishers in Amsterdam published, meaning they made pamphlets of the nusachs of these cherems, which you can see in this book I have. It's really cool. And and they distribute them free all over Klal Yisrael in Europe because they don't want anybody to buy the other edition. Acher kach bo mafe zalman something lifnei David Strauss of Firth. So the Sulzbach guy went to the nearby yeshiva in Firth, which was a very big yeshiva, and he says, and basically, let's put it this way, that's a local boy. And Robert Strauss, you never heard of, but he's in that book from, what's his name? Mr. Yecky, the three volumes in the Yeshiva Firth. Rabbi Hamburger. He's in there. That's a major work on the Yeshiva. There's three volumes. For Yomer Shigishal, Tainus Gedolus Negan Amav of Amsterdam Propus, that he has Tainus against the Amsterdam thing. For Yavol Din Torah, he said, come to a Din Torah here in Firth. So get this. The guy from Amsterdam should travel halfway across Europe to Firth to go to Din Torah. And the other guy didn't go. And they also, Sivoshal Sada, the Yonim, made so double Strauss. So in Firth, they got together 10 Dayonim, but Sivakal Parmas and Govakil with all the big Yekis. But also, there were Shnei Yamim, and they were Nosim, but not in the Indian for 2 days. And they were Matar the Cherim because it's cheap. The one in Amsterdam was too expensive, it's only for the richy riches. This one will be much cheaper. Hafasasa Bazil, Vichoma Fabenu Liknosa, right? And so the Yeshiva guys can afford this one. And all I know is, it's famous that our hero got in there, and he sided with the cheapskates. He sided with the ones who said that it's okay to publish it, because it's for the public benefit. So this is, you're getting at the questions of, what's the right word? Monopolies, okay? And there are all kinds of Jewish angles on monopoly, especially in medieval Jewish law. Not in Talmudic Jewish law, but in medieval Jewish law. And this is part of the history of the printing press. Anyway, maybe I'll say that for another time. The point is, as I said before, with this I'll conclude, we're dealing with a major figure, like the Notabi Huda. He really is. He's like that, you know. He's like Rabbi Kiveger, like Yaakov Memden and Chagas Aryeh. He's in that rank. He's much less known, except to people, like I said before, like I heard, you know, the Sheet of the Base Mayor with the Dover Kharif and what else? There's a couple other things out there. If you look around, I'm sure you'll see. You know, I remember there's something about can you call Shabbos for Goyim or something like that. I forget how it goes. There's also a payment sheet to the base mayor, right? Can you be Mechal Shabbos for, can you violate Shabbos to help a non-Shabbos observant Jew? Okay? 1 minute, here it is. Base Mayor Erchaim Shin Laman, Kivan Shalom de Chazal, Chalel Alav Shabbos Achas, Kadei Sheishma Shabbos Harbe, that the heter, like the Maccabees, you know, that he can be Mechal one Shabbos because the idea is the guy will keep Shabbos after that. You get it? For example, Pekuch Nefesh or when they fought against the Shmad in the time of the Greeks. Chalil Shabbos Achas, Kadei Sheishma Shabbos Harbe. So what if the guy's not going to be keeping Shabbos Harbe? Isn't that interesting? Now, Rabbi Kiveger disagreed with that. So you have two friends, and how should I put it? And Rabbi Kiveger looked up to him, but on that particular inyan, they disagreed. And to tell you the truth, I wouldn't have thought so, because in Danzig, well, yeah, you had plenty of Mechal Shabbos in Danzig. I should take that away. Even though it's before the Haskalah, but you did. This became a very important question, you know, Sam Sofer and others deal about it in the 1800s when so many people went off to Derech. Anyway, I just wanted to give you a little taste of who we're dealing with over here. If you're interested, you'll pursue on your own, especially the arguments about the printing of the Shas, all the rest of it. Maybe I'll do that another time. And again, this is in the Gnozim catalog. So if the Beis Meir interests you, you actually have the Mechaber's own edition, you know, his personal copy and his notes. I'm telling you again, he's a perfectionist. I'm sure he's going through over here and saying, I want to change. I want to rethink this. And when we have the second publication, we'll do it this way. And that's what Mechon Yisrael is supposed to have done. That's what I was told. And we're talking over here only 30 to 80K. Yes, that's garnished. as garnished, and that would really be something. So anyway, with that, again, the Gnozim auction is 2 Sundays from today, right? It's September 7th, okay? So it's 2 weeks before Rosh Hashanah. Wow, how would you like to get this in the mail on Rosh Hashanah? the original base mayor from the base mayor himself. Anyway, with that, I wish you a good day.